Welcome to another episode of the Civitas podcast, which is an expression of the Theopolis Institute. This podcast originated out of years of discussions and conversations around book studies and essay studies on the topic of liberalism and the post-liberal discourse generally. We are now, I think, in the sixth episode of this podcast between myself and my co-host, Peter Lighthart. And today we have a very special opportunity just to take what I'm calling an interlude or an intermission in our conversations that we've been having thus far. The first episode was just me and Peter introducing the podcast, me introducing myself. But the successive episodes have been with guests, friends of ours who contribute to political theology in various ways. We had a friend. The last episode was Brad Littlejohn summarizing kind of magisterial Protestant political theology, building off of also a conversation that we had with Glenn Moots, who offered a similar contribution. In the middle of those, we also had a conversation with a friend, DC Schindler. And then I think that is it. Yes, I think that's it. We started with our friend Jim Rogers.
Yeah, you forgot the kingpin of the Civitas group.
Yes. And so Jim, professor of political science at Texas A&M University, and he organized the entire Civitas, the genesis of the Civitas project, and helped coordinate our discussions. And one of the things I've very much appreciate about Jim is that he makes sure that as we critique liberalism and try to provide some alternative, that we steel man the liberal case. And so we looked at many classical readings in liberal theory. But in light of those conversations we had, we wanted to launch a podcast to have a more public-facing expression of these discussions. And so that is between Peter and myself. And what we are trying to articulate, and we're kind of gesturing at, we're continuing to build what our project is in many ways, is an ecclesiocentric post-liberalism. And so therefore, we'll get into that a little bit today as we pause with our discussions with other friends, and we just talked amongst ourselves to continue to specify what we understand our project to be, what liberalism is, and how we situate ourselves in the broader kind of post-liberal discourse. And so that's kind of where we're going to go today. We'll have a little bit of structure, but I assume we'll go all over the place. But one of the things I wanted to do, maybe just to guide us and provide some structure, is to launch this with some questions of my co-host, because particularly Peter has written a kind of a seminal kind of programmatic essay in a book that's coming out. Peter, does the book have a title?
I think that the title will be "The Gates of Hell Shall Not Prevail."
Nice. And so that's a forthcoming book with some of the other participants in the Civitas conversations. And Peter, you know, wrote a very important essay, which was published in distilled form at Theopolis already. And so I want to be able to ask him a little bit more about what he articulated there. But I think maybe before we get into his essay, but this already dabbles, it already will be gesturing towards some of the arguments he makes there, is I do want to maybe just start by having you, Peter, and I'll bounce back and forth with you, discuss how we understand liberalism, because I think that's maybe something our audience might not be fully aware of, maybe where we're coming from on that. And so one of the things that you say, maybe we'll kind of see where you go with this in your essay, is that many post-liberals miss the target in their critiques of liberalism. Why did you say that? Where do you think they miss the target?
Yeah, maybe the key post-liberal or writer or critic of liberalism that I have in mind there is Patrick Deneen in his widely read book, Why Liberalism Failed. But he's symptomatic of a kind of critique of liberalism that is pretty widespread, which focuses on philosophical questions and particularly on questions about anthropology. And so he thinks that liberalism is essentially a radical individualism that subordinates everything to the choices of individuals, and these choices of individuals are not constrained or limited by anything outside. If they are constrained or limited, then that's a violation of individual freedom. And so institutions and social structures have to be modified to maximize the freedom of choice that people have. that along with his he also talks about the other kind of philosophical plank he talks about is the idea that we're being liberated not just from social constraints, but we're being liberated, at least in the current form of liberalism, from constraints of nature. And you see this obviously in transgenderism and other kinds of sexual ideologies, but not just there. He sees it in environmental degradation. We're trying to liberate ourselves from the constraints of matter, for example, in the uprooting that of people from place, mm-hmm. You know, the kind of cosmopolitan way of life that it doesn't have any connection with actual locations. That's a symptom of the same kind of attempt to liberate ourselves from our human constraints and from finitude. So that what's missing there, I think those are legitimate critiques of contemporary liberalism. Well, I think what's missing that misses the target, I think, in two ways. One is Dineen and others tend to project these notions of liberalism back to the origins of liberalism. And that's very much part of Dineen's argument, that there's a strong continuity between founding theorists of liberalism, including founders of the American order, and contemporary liberalism. That what we're seeing is just kind of the logical outworking of bad ideas and philosophical errors that are kind of embedded from the beginning. So that's one thing I think.
Why is that wrong, you're saying? Well,
I think that's conflating the contemporary form of liberalism, which I think he critiques very effectively, mm-hmm. with something like the liberalism of the founding fathers, or even the liberalism of an Adam Smith, and certainly the liberalism insofar as you can think of Burke, Edmund Burke as a kind of liberal. Mm-hmm. Those are all very different. And projecting contemporary liberalism back and seeing it's just a logical outworking, that it kind of smooths out the contingencies of history.
Yeah.
So I think in that respect, it misses the point. I think it also misses the point as a historical argument, because the issues out of which liberal theory mm-hmm. emerged and liberal forms of political order emerge, those issues all surround religious conflict and religious combat. So it's a post-Reformation Western development, that is, liberal theory is a post-Reformation development, and it develops. This is the argument of my essay in the Civitas book that will come out hopefully sometime this summer. But the setting for the development of liberal theory, innovative political theory, is the post-Reformation, the breakdown of medieval order, the breakdown of the unity of the Catholic Church that provided kind of overarching unity to Europe. That breaks down, and you have instead a situation of religious pluralism across Europe, and even within countries. You have countries that are divided between Protestant sectors and Catholic sectors. And the question then becomes, how do you manage public religion? That's actually the historical question that's being asked, partly by people like Locke. He's a little bit later, but have some mm-hmm. earlier thinkers. Hobbes is not exactly a liberal thinker, but he has some overlap insofar as he's a social contract theorist. There's some overlap with what he's doing with the way liberal theorists more technically develop. So at the heart of those proposals, I'm arguing in the paper, at the heart of the proposals, I focus on Hobbes and Locke. There's a revisionary ecclesiology. The longest section of Leviathan is about ecclesiastical government. It's the part that's always left out of abridged versions of Leviathan. You know,
they
focus on the earlier sections that have to do with the political questions of the social contract theory, but then mm-hmm. a huge section of Leviathan is devoted to a kind of revised understanding of the church. And in this revised understanding, the church is not what the New Testament says it is. The church is not what medieval Christians believed it to be. It's not even what reformers thought the church was. Mm-hmm. The reformers mm-hmm. believed that the church was a divine institution. It's created and sustained by God, by Jesus Christ, and by His Spirit. For Hobbes, the church doesn't exist at all as church in the early centuries, because it doesn't have this kind of political position that comes into being only with Constantine. He thinks that the church becomes church only when it's personified in the person of the king or the person of the emperor. And that's the way he thinks about, for example, English order. And it works in England because you have the king is by Hobbes's time, you've already had Henry VIII and you've had a century plus of the Church of England with the king as the head of the church. And the church has a public life, but it's embodied and it's embodied in the king. He personifies, in Hobbes's view, the king personifies the church. And then the church is kind of integrated into the public order of England. So in some ways that's still a kind of Christendom model, but what's happened there is that the church has ceased to be this overarching body as it was in the medieval era. It's become subordinate, in Hobbes's thought, radically subordinate to the Leviathan, to royal power. Even things like the interpretation of scripture has to become instead of being a province of the church, it has to become a royal responsibility. One of the things that Hobbes is targets is what he talks about, the doubleness, you're seeing double, yeah, that happens with in Christendom. You have two different overlapping institutions. So anyway, I spend a good bit of time in the essay talking about Hobbes, talking about Locke, and in both cases, I see at one of the central things that they're doing is modifying their understanding of the church. And so my argument is that liberalism, I could put it softly and say liberalism implies a modified ecclesiology. I argue for the more radical claim that liberalism is heretical ecclesiology, or maybe a set of heretical ecclesiologies, because there are some differences between different liberal theorists. But so in that sense, an argument that just looks at the philosophical character or just the political institutions of modern liberal order is missing what I think is the historically, and I think in terms of political theory and a Christian political theory especially, what I think is really the uniqueness of liberalism is its either explicit or implied understanding of the church.
So could we just pause for a second and also maybe articulate who are the key figures in developing liberal theory, just so we kind of identify those. So you mentioned Hobbes and Locke, but you also said that, you know, Hobbes is like a somewhat of a complicated figure. Is he a liberal, right, or not? Right. So maybe you could speak to that, but also who are some other kind of key figures in developing liberal theory? And then we'll come back. I think we'll circle back to the background of the origins of liberal theory and then kind of how we understand a Theopolitan response. But maybe just to lay the groundwork, who would be some other major
figures? Well, I mean, jumping ahead past the 17th century, I mean, Mill is an important, this is part of the complication of the discussion. Almost everyone sees Locke as a kind of proto-liberal thinker, but the term liberalism isn't used. He doesn't use that to describe his own theory. That doesn't come into currency until later in the 19th century, mm-hmm, at least in English. And somebody like John Stuart Mill. And you have his book on liberty, the title of which I can't call to mind right now. He establishes the principle of harm. Everyone has basically freedom to do whatever they like, to embark on experiments in living. I think that's his exact phrase, if not his exact phrase, a paraphrase of the way he speaks about it. Everyone has the freedom to experiment with ways of life. And the only limit is that you can't experiment with a way of life that causes harm to another, that infringes somehow on the rights of another. So Mill is an important figure. You have some French theorists. Benjamin Constant is an important theorist earlier on. Kant is actually quite an important figure, both in developing liberal theory and also in thinking about kind of international order from this perspective. I mean, the elements would include some kind of theory of a social contract, mm-hmm, that public order emerges out of a state, at least theoretically. You can do this thought experiment, emerges out of a state prior to any kind of social order. So social order is all grounded in the consent of people who have formed that social order. That's a fairly constant element of liberal theory. Maximizing freedom is an important part of liberal theory. that you're trying to remove constraints that would both constrain individual conduct and also constrain society as a whole. But I think, again, the central thing has to do with within the development of Western political theory. I think the central innovation is in its understanding of the public character of the church and the public role of the church. I mean, you can move ahead into the 20th century, and the leading figure in the 20th century is John Rawls.
Yeah.
Who has a kind of social contract theory. He imagines people in a state prior to any kind of obligations, any knowledge of their position in society. And behind the veil of ignorance, they're ignorant of how they're going to fare and the position they're going to have in this society. And they have to decide on what counts as fairness and what kind of institutions they want to have without knowing how they're going to, what position they're going to have in society. That's a kind of social contract model.
Yeah, a couple of comments on that. Yeah, I mean, the last point you made about the Rawls thing, that's another common thread in a lot of post-liberal critiques, right, is the hidden metaphysical, theological, kind of religious, substantive right. decisions that liberalism makes that constantly smuggles in. So when you say, like, no harm, already there's implied conceptions of what harm is, right. That they're not being made in an explicit public manner, and therefore they're kind of uncontestable. And then with Rawls, right? Yeah, I mean, it rules out these comprehensive doctrines and all these things, but already it's presupposing a certain comprehensive doctrine that right. those considerations of truth and God are irrelevant to the public order. That's already a pretty significant substantive conclusion that is kind of implied. Right. I'll just make a couple comments too about general threads and liberalism. Right. You mentioned Kant, because I do think another kind of presupposition of many modern liberal theories, right, is it's premised upon a certain rationalism as well. And therefore that then leads into things like the emergence of modern ideologies, which are kind of these kind of technocratic kind of intellectual schemes for control, because man has emancipated himself. Well, how do we organize the world according to our own will? And that already gestures at a lot of the kind of fundamental critiques of liberalism, other than just ours, right? Is it's kind of grounded in this voluntarism that also itself is grounded in a prior shifts in late medieval philosophy and theology about the nature of God, mm-hmm. Right? Radicalizing the distinction between potentia absoluta and potentia ordinata, and God, as we conceive of His sovereignty, now is unbounded, unrelated to anything else other than just pure will. And so then, that's also related to nominalism, and it's really so all these things are attached, but kind of undergirding the emergence of liberal theory. Okay, so there's those, and also the shifts away, I think, in the early modern period from Aristotelian teleology, I think would be another major consideration.
Yeah, right.
That comes up with, like, a lot of people identify Machiavelli, right, as the genesis. That's like the Straussian move, right, as the genesis of modern political theory, and he is explicitly anti-Aristotelian.
If I could just throw something, I do think it's important that I do want to make a distinction that other post-liberal critics of liberalism make, that post-liberalism is not the same as anti-liberalism or illiberalism. That there's room to recognize the gains of modern political theory and modern political practice in areas like, there are genuine injustices and inequities that were part of traditional societies, and that liberalism has been an instrument for ordering those in a more equitable fashion. It's liberal kinds of theories, in part at least, that drive the securing of rights for minorities, for example. Mm-hmm. The securing of what I think are of genuine rights for women. Those kind of movements, although they can take extreme and radical expressions, they can be expressions of liberalism of liberal instincts that have beneficial effects on society rather than undermining them.
Yeah, and I did want to identify other post-liberal moves and why we choose that label. But yeah, I agree, and I think, but also I think another critique, and I think you even make it in your essay, right, is the things you just identified were genuine modern developments that come out of much of liberalism. But a lot of, you know, what's fascinating, I think, is a lot of things that people identify as right. as actual liberal contributions actually themselves are have pre-liberal antecedents, right? So it's like the, you know, separation of powers or the rule of law or constitutionalism, all of those things predate liberalism itself. And I think you actually even mentioned that in your essay, if I'm recalling correctly. Yeah. And one of the key figures for that, whose important work would be Francis Oakley's little trilogy of, you know, of the emergence of a lot of the kind of liberal institutional arrangements themselves kind of already are grounded in, you know, the development of common law, Roman law, but also the conciliarist in the late medieval period. And so I think that's also good to remember that, you know, some of the things that we identify as liberal themselves are not necessarily liberal, but also we are, when we embrace the label post-liberal, I think that's already signaling the fact that we're not just trying to return to some earlier period or just in entirely anti-liberal. Because that another figure I wanted to bring up when I question maybe some of the maybe blind spots even in our own project that I'm continuing to wrestle with is that, you know, I studied under Ephraim Radner. Mm-hmm. For my dissertation, and this is one of the key contributions he makes to this discourse is that liberalism. So we quickly return back to the idea of liberalism as a heretical ecclesiology, and that being a core consideration that we want to add. But also Radner challenges some of the especially the anti-liberal critiques is that, you know, liberalism emerges out of the church's failures. So it's not just liberalism radically reduces and revises a proper ecclesiology, but liberalism itself is a reflection of a failed ecclesiology.
Yeah, right.
And I think that's an important consideration. The church was failing to bring about unity and to embody unity.
Right. Right.
And it was violent. And we can't run from that's, you know, he opens up a brutal unity with like 50 pages. Kind of critiquing Kavanaugh's myth of religion's violence, of religion's violence thesis. And it's like, look, we can't run away from our own failures that liberalism responded to. I just bring that up. I don't know if you have any thoughts about that before I just continue to rant. But
yeah, no, I think that's right. I agree with that. You can kind of imagine in an alternate universe where the Catholic Church is agreeable to listen to hearing Luther out,
mm-hmm.
and to recognizing the force of some of his critiques, and you can imagine an alternate universe perhaps where Luther is somewhat less of a bulldog in his maybe not. I don't think there probably would not have been a Reformation, but yeah, you can imagine a situation where you have this massive upheaval in the church. You had to have massive upheavals in the church before. I mean, you had moments in the medieval period when there were multiple popes, and that had to be resolved by various councils and things. So you can imagine a situation where the church actually is able to resolve this and is able to bring some semblance of unity, acknowledging the legitimacy of Protestant critiques, or even incorporating those critiques, incorporating Protestants into a Catholic framework. You can imagine that kind of outcome, or a church that's an entire church that's radically reformed by Protestant principles. Either of those are theoretically possible, but yeah, neither of those happened, obviously. And probably in the event that neither one is really likely to have happened because of the pre-existing corruptions within the Catholic Church. It was not likely that they were going to listen to the kind of radical critique that the reformers brought. But yeah, I think that's right. There's definitely a failure of the church. And I'm probably more favorable to William Kavanaugh's thesis than Radner suggests. Because, I mean, Kavanaugh's thesis is not that Catholics and Protestants didn't kill each other. His thesis is that it's mischaracterization to say that the dividing lines are religious dividing lines, or that the overarching story of that period of European history is religious conflict. He instead places it in the context of state building, and what you have is often you have state building kings and other state builders who are using religious conflict in one way or another in order to advance their political interests. And that means that the battle lines are much more complicated than the popular understanding of religious war suggests. There are Catholics and Protestants on different sides, mixed up on different sides of wars, and the lines aren't clean between along religious lines. But having said that, the way we imagine history is really important. It's not just what happened, but how people imagined what happened. And the recollection of religious war is the motivating starting point for Hobbes. It's one of the things that's haunting Locke and other early modern theorists. They want to find a way for people to live together when they have radically different theological perspectives.
Yep.
Even if it's a myth, it's a myth that has profound real world effects.
Yeah. I'll just add a couple of things there. Yeah. I mean, I agree. I think there's a way to harmonize. When I came to Wycliffe to study with him, that was one of my goals, was to figure out a way to harmonize. Because I start my political and ecclesiological reflections very differently than Ephraim. But that's a side note. But yeah, I think Kavanaugh's also arguing a couple things as well that I think are relevant here, is the idea that the wars of religion already creates this thing that's called religion. That's right. Entirely separable, right?
Right.
From politics. And so already there's a major move implied there. That's one thing. Another thing would be that those wars are unique, rather than, you know, wars at other, like, you know, that era wasn't necessarily more violent than the 20th century, which gets to another one, right? Which is like, the 20th century has great, you know, has great devastation and destruction wrought by quote unquote atheistic ideologies, you know?
Right.
And so I think there's a few things going on that I think you could still honor Kavanaugh's argument and try to bring it in. But, you know, one of the things I found fascinating just revisiting in preparation for this conversation, Hobbes and Locke's arguments, thinking about Hobbes, the whole kind of proto, you know, a version of Erastianism that he because another failure, so one of Ratner's other arguments I think is important, is not just that we failed to be unified, we failed at unity, but we also failed to be tolerant, and that the emergence of liberal theory is a chastening on the church there as well, we've got to learn, it's actually teaching us to be tolerant. And one of the things that I can't speak for Ratner, but one of the things I would still add now is the liberal order is not tolerant, right, as it purports to be, and we're seeing that in various ways. But I do think that's another. With Hobbes, he actually thought that giving more power to more sovereignty to the civil ruler would actually be more tolerant, because the church was an absolutist, you know.
Right.
So it wasn't just the wars of religion; it was also like both the Roman and, you know, kind of Calvinist theocracies in his mind, right? Were intolerant, and he thought that this liberal state that, you know, that's anachronistic, but giving kind of absolute sovereignty to the civil magistrate would be a way to secure more tolerance and toleration. I think that's an interesting contribution to the conversation. But
yeah, so the church's failure of charity as well as unity obviously go together. But yeah, I think that's exactly right.
And then as we think about imagining, recalling back to our conversation with Dr. Schindler, but also you brought up here how we imagine our history, right? I think it's important, because it also, I think a couple of things, maybe now getting into our proposals that I think we still have questions to wrestle with here that I'll bring up. But how we imagine, first of all, how do we imagine the church? Because what emerges with liberal theory is a profound reconception of the church that is, I think, radically reduced. So that's one thing that I want us to discuss, and for you to elaborate more. What do you think happens there? How does the church get reconceived in a very problematic way? But then also, how do we imagine moving forward, right? Would be a big question I still have. Just put this on the burner for the conversation as you articulate some of your positions. A big question I have as we think about reconceiving again, retrieving our robust understanding of the church and its political nature. How do you do that in a divided church? I mean, what do we do with the world that we've inherited? And so that's a big kind of lingering question I still have, you know, theoretically and practically. But maybe could you just start there on the imagination? You know, how was the church? Again, you said liberalism is a heretical ecclesiology. So again, could you just spell out more? How was the church reconceived in liberal theory?
Yeah. I mean, it's easy to see, for example, if you compare what both Hobbes and Locke and other, you know, other later theorists say about the church. I mean, the church kind of drops out of consideration at some point. It becomes a completely separate zone of concern, which is in my view is part of the problem. It's no longer integral to ecclesiology, is no longer integral to political thought at some point. I don't know where that point comes, but it's still there in, certainly in Hobbes, he spends a lot of time on ecclesiology. It's still there in Locke to some degree, but at some point Western theorists begin to do political theory without even thinking about the church. And Rawls can think about religion in general, but he's not concerned about any kind of ecclesiological revisions. So the fact that you can have political theory as a separate concern that doesn't touch on ecclesiology at all, that itself is at a theoretical level, that's an indication of the church's contraction. It's the contraction of the church as an institution is accompanied by kind of the expansion of the polity as to be the all-encompassing concern of political theory.
Can I just interject there too? Yes. One of the fascinating things just about studying, and I didn't get a lot of this in seminary or anything like this, of just the history of political thought. Even if you go pick up like the Cambridge History of Political Thought, this kind of massive companion volume, and then they keep adding more. But the first one is primarily focused on like medieval political theory, and it's fascinating. It's very well written, and but when you go back and look at it, it's I don't know how many of the authors are Christian or something, but if you go back and just read that. It's fascinating how much of that volume focusing on political theory centers in on church and civil power relations. Mm-hmm. That they view that even just historians of political theory, even in the medieval period, see that drama as central to what politics is.
Right.
And that drama is radically sidelined in modern theory. I just find that even just interesting, even if you're not coming from our perspective, you can see a major shift.
Yes.
Even just in how the discourse plays itself out.
Yeah. So that was the first step of my answer to your question was that if you compare the medieval ecclesiology and its understanding of relationship between temporal and spiritual authorities, compare that to what you get in early modern, particularly Protestant thinkers or Protestant influenced thinkers. I mean, there's a pretty dramatic difference there. And I think I'm not entirely sold on that medieval paradigm. One of the fundamental claims is correct. This is a point that I think that Oakley makes, that there's, oh no, it's the recent book on Aquinas's on kingship. I can't remember who the author of that book
is. Bill McCormick. We'll have him on in the future. Yeah.
Yeah.
Great little book.
It is. And he points out that you have this distinction between temporal and spiritual power. That's kind of a plank of medieval political theory. But it's not just the distinction, but it's the ranking. Mm-hmm. So that the spiritual provides the overarching telos. Political authority is exercised for the sake of spiritual ends, or the state exists for the sake of the building up of the people of God, which is the church. So I think those are defensible claims, both the distinction between temporal and spiritual, that way of stating the distinction I'm not as keen on, but some kind of distinction between civil authority and ecclesial authority. And then the ecclesial authority is the overarching kind of, or the ecclesial community is kind of the overarching community.
You did two things there. Can you just, because I think that people who would have questions about what you just said, because you mentioned two things. One is you said, you're not totally convinced on the language of temporal authority versus spiritual authority. Could you speak to that one? And then the other one of saying, and then you also said not only authority, but the community. So maybe if you could just pause and elaborate
on your
reticence about those labels.
Yeah. On the language itself, the language can give the impression, for example, that the church has no concern for realities that take place in time.
Yeah.
It's only concern. And this is part of what Locke is arguing for, that the church is a community, a private voluntary association that is completely devoted to the service of souls, to the saving of souls. that kind of the terminology of the distinction between temporal and spiritual can give that impression, as if the church has no concern with temporal matters,
yep,
or as if the state has no concern with spiritual matters. And I just think it's, that's not the way that the medievals conceived of it, but the terminology can lend itself to that. So I think civil ecclesial is preferable, I think, for that reason. And the reason I backed away from talking about authority is I looked at you and I remembered de Lubac, and I didn't want to set things up with a jurisdictional understanding of the relationship between church and state.
You remembered Milbanker.
If you're just talking in terms of authority, then it can lend itself to a kind of extrinsicism or juridical understanding of the church, where the church is just an authoritative body of an authoritative civic order, as it were, an alternative civic order that exists kind of on the same plane but has a different realm of jurisdiction. And that it's not that. The church is the body of Christ. The church is a completely other kind of community. So in contrast to that medieval conception, the modern theorists and liberal theorists are radically departing. And I think then what I have in mind especially is not that contrast between medieval and modern, but the contrast between what I believe is the biblical description and portrayal of the church and the way that modern liberal theorists talk about the church. The church is described not invariably, but very consistently in the New Testament in political terms.
Yep.
I've made this point in a lot of different writings. I've written the same book several times making this point. But you know, ecclesia, that's a term that just drawn out of the Greek polis. It's a citizen assembly of the polis. Peter talks about the church as a nation. The vision of the bride is a civic vision at the end of Revelation, at the end of the Bible, and that's I think a portrayal not just of a future city, but of a future city that already has a presence in the present, which means that the church is inherently a political order.
Yep.
There's
a few other New Testament terms, right, you could use for that. Even Paul, already wrestling with your understanding of the, even before Paul, just in the synoptics and relationship to the epistles, how you understand the shift from Basileia to Theo language, kingdom language, over to ecclesia.
Yeah.
There's a radical semantic shift. And how do you understand it? That you go kind of like an Alfred Lossie direction. It's like, oh, you know, Jesus preached the kingdom. Unfortunately, he got the church. Or is there actually something more positive relationship between those two terminologies? But then you get even just Paul, internal to Paul himself, right? I wrote this in my recent Theopolis essays. And one of my favorite little contributions to the study of Ephesians has been made as you and your Delivered from the Elements of the World book, I think, in the appendix, when you talk about how a lot of Reformed theology even neglects the back half of Ephesians 2, right? But that's integrally related to the atoning work that Christ accomplished in Ephesians, the first part of Ephesians 2. But that then you get all this very richly political language. Like you've been invited into a commonwealth. Right, you've been made citizens and fellow members. There's a very strong, even kind of robustly civic terminology, even in that description of the accomplishments of the atonement, even internal to Paul there as well. I mean, the citizens' language is used also in like Philippians and elsewhere. But anyway, I was just going to throw that in.
Yeah, yeah. I cite Pierre Monnet in my essay, who makes the claim at the beginning of his History of Liberalism that the great problematic of Western political thought is reckoning with the reality of the church.
Yes.
This is a completely new kind of thing that makes its appearance in the midst of the Roman Empire. It's not another empire that looks like the Roman Empire. It's not exactly a nation, but it acts like a nation in certain respects. It doesn't in other ways, nor is it simply a religious body. It's just sui generis. It's something completely new.
Yes.
And, Western political thought has been about that, trying to reckon with that. So I think if you're going to do Christian political theory, you can't not do that. Yeah. You can't deal with politics without reckoning with that reality.
And I'll just make a couple comments. I mean, I'm glad you put the Monnet stuff, because that's huge in my dissertation. I think that's one of the I think Monnet is extremely sharp there among contemporary political philosophers. I think he gets it better than anybody.
Yeah.
I think he actually develops Straussian logic in even more robustly Christian direction, because he uses Strauss's term, the theological political problem, but he doesn't ground it in like the drama between reason and revelation. He grounds it in civil and political power, in relationships. And he says, like, you know, the church, and I'll get to how modern, let me briefly mention how modern political theories actually reflect this, right? But he mentions how the church is disruptive, and inherently so, to political loyalties. That inaugurates this problem because it both, he says, it, and he's kind of building off Marcel Gauchet a little bit here, that it liberates the secular to kind of be purely secular, like, and it honors that in a certain way, but it also institutes a profound problem by proclaiming a certain community that is transnational, local and transtemporal, that all persons are open to and ordered to ultimately. And that inaugurates a problem that you can't ever avoid. And I think where you get in the modern political theorists is they recognize that. First of all, Rome recognized this, right? The Romans did. They recognized that the church was problematic in this sense. Yeah. But also, you mentioned the seeing double that Hobbes that Hobbes references. But also, you even get precursors to that in like Marsilius of Padua.
Yeah.
And then Grotius develops this when it comes to Marsilius does. Very explicitly Hobbes does. And then what you see, I think, and Rousseau builds on this, and Rousseau, that's what's what Rousseau loves about Hobbes. He loves that Hobbes recognizes this drama that's instituted by the church. And he thinks that Hobbes solves it in a satisfactory way, that we no longer have to see double between church and state. We just identify with the state and we don't have to see the drama between the two powers. Just the state subordinates it. But then you say, I love in your essay too, one of the things you do is you draw attention to Locke, that he almost, you don't get the sense of the drama in Locke almost, but because it's almost the way he solves it in this covert way. And could you explain that maybe even just a little bit, how you don't get the drama of the seeing double so much in Locke, but how does he resolve it? And then how does that, we just almost assume the Lockean frame, you know?
Yeah. Well, I think part of the issue with Locke is just a different historical setting than somebody like Hobbes. Another several decades away from religious war. Religious war is not the motivating or the driving factor for him. Instead, it's a free church, toleration of free church and other kinds of non-Anglicans within an Anglican establishment. So part of it is that it's in some ways the stakes are lowered because some of the pressure has been diffused. But I think too that his solution is to declare the church to be a voluntary society that exists, as I said, for the sake of the salvation of the soul. So it's restricting the church to that kind of very narrow scope of interest, and then you don't have the drama because the church has its own little bailiwick, and it can deal with internal matters. It can deal with, because it's been depoliticized, it can deal with all the things that it's supposed to deal with without at all impinging on public order.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's one of the lingering questions I have about, let's throw this out here as a hornet's nest, but worth revisiting another time, is one of the questions I have about the ongoing kind of viability of kind of classic two kingdoms thought, which I'm drawn to in a lot of ways, but I think certain proponents of it inherit subconsciously Lockean frameworks.
Yeah.
But also, I think when two kingdoms political theology works really well is still in kind of the remnants of Christendom, where you could make these clean divisions between internal and external and things like that, when the whole order is kind of is kind of framed in Christian terms, right? Mm-hmm. But I think when you get in a kind of a post-Christian situation, that becomes increasingly more problematic. And I share with you a reticence about the internal external kind of thing. I mean, because when I look even to just for instance, very simple things like the household codes or like the constant, like, ethical imperatives that the church is speaking to, it's not just preparing people for heavenly life, right? It is shaping them for temporal existence.
Right.
In very visible ways.
Yeah. In our conversation with Brad Littlejohn, I think that, that was one of the things that we focused on, and I have the similar kind of objection, partly terminological, but not just terminological, that I have to the the classic medieval temporal spiritual distinction.
Yeah.
Because it lends itself, I think you're right, to a kind of Lockean, there's a kind of Lockean pressure to privatize the church and to think of the church as having a very restricted spiritual role. When we press Brad on various things, he's recognizing all kinds of overlap and interpenetration between what he's thinking of as two kingdoms. But that's not the way that everyone thinks about it. There's a tendency to think about the civil kingdom as having, I think of the Meredith Klein inspired kind of dualism that you have in some
Westminster West.
In some reform circles where you have this very tightly restricted civic realm that's governed by different standards and rules than the ecclesial realm. You have the realm of common culture and the realm of holy culture, that kind of distinction that Klein makes. And when you have that kind of setup, I think I just don't think it's describing reality, for one thing. And I don't think it's just feeding into this same heretical ecclesiology that I charge liberalism with. It's accepting the terrain that liberalism allows the church, and treating that as what, this is the terrain that God has given us, rather than, one of the ways that Manette describes it is one of the sources of the drama is the absoluteness and the theocratic claim that the church makes to be able to speak to everything.
That's what I love about de Lubac. I mentioned this, the word spiritual also makes, and I think you share this with me, so I know this, but the way we use the word spiritual grates, I grate against it, because spiritual doesn't mean less real or invisible. Spiritual is more real. And when I love what de Lubac, when he has this little essay on temporal authority, the church's authority in temporal matters. And he says, he explicitly uses that language instead of over temporal, whatever. He's like, look, but one of the things he says is the church's authority is spiritual, and therefore it always should be shaped by that consideration. There are ways that the language of spiritual does shape our conception of authority, of the authority that the church has. But he says, but everything's spiritual. And so it's he's speaking into everything. So there's nothing that the spiritual does not touch. And so one of the things that I have a question about, though, if that's true, and what we're saying is like, look, we want to reject and push back against the kind of Lockean reduction. I think our listeners will be asking, is this just a version of ecclesiocracy or kind of integralism? Is that what we're promoting? And if not, then why not? And what's different then that we're promoting? That we want the church to be this political body. We want it to be publicly significant in its own right. We want the authorities to recognize it in certain ways. Could you speak to that?
Yeah, let me comment somewhat indirectly, because I think we left a previous question hanging.
Oh, okay.
From earlier, because you had asked about the way I'm thinking about the reconception of the church that takes place.
Yes, thank you.
And then you also asked about, what do we do in a divided church? What's the what's the program? To me, that's one of the strengths of an ecclesiocentric perspective. That in some ways, I certainly am not saying the church or individual Christians can blissfully ignore the goings on of the political world, what goes on in Washington, or in my case, what goes on in Montgomery, or what's going on in the mayor's office down the street here in Gardendale, Alabama. I'm not saying that we ignore those, but there's a certain detachment from dependence on that an ecclesiocentric position gives. And there are ways to pursue, since the church is a polity, since the church itself has that kind of public character, part of what the church needs to do is simply accept its character as a public, accept its character as God's ordained instrument for renewing the world, for renewing humanity, for renewing the human city. And there's all kinds of things that the church can do they can be modest. I'm talking about very modest kinds of pursuits, a modest kind of agenda, but a real agenda that has real world local impacts. And churches do that all over the place. There are many churches that with which I have theological disagreements that are much more effective at actually doing things than any church I've ever been part of, any church I've ever pastored. But I think what they're not recognizing is that kind of local work to address local you know, if you have, if you're a church in an inner city and you're trying to address the problem of gangs, or you're trying to address the problem of poverty, or you're in a city that's divided racially and you're trying to address racial divisions within a city, all of those are the church pursuing a political program. And that is an assertion over against the kind of, again, the liberal pressure to keep the church out of that kind of public role. It's modest, it's small, but it doesn't involve kind of a massive takeover of the institutions. So I think that's one of the, actually the practical side of it is, I think, one of the strengths of what we've been working on, because there's all kinds of opportunities that churches have to make a public and political difference that don't depend on having any kind of formal civil power.
Can I add maybe a brief thing there?
Sure.
One of the things that I think our project offers too is, you mentioned when we were talking about authority, and one of the reasons I have a reticence about just jumping to that language, right? When we think about the type of subordination, right? Because I think what I'm not proposing, and I don't think you are, right, is the state submits like in this very explicit whole way to the church and everything. No, I don't. Yeah. You know, we're not just seeking to grab onto power. But okay, so maybe if we talk about subordination more as ordering, which you could read into the language of subordination, right? Then you can have a thicker sense of actually what classical Presbyterian theology talks about, like the spirituality of the church, which I tend to not like that because it tends to go in this kind of radical two kingdoms privatization. But if you think about this thick notion of spiritual, right, is that and then you could understand it's almost a symbolic nature of what the church is. It's both the fascinating thing I think our project's trying to hold together is how does the church destabilize and disrupt kind of political identities, right, and loyalties, at the same time being a model to them. Mm-hmm. And so trying to do both at the same time. And therefore, where it's complicated is also thinking about the church as itself, not within the civil realm, not within a state, but the more comprehensive community, mm-hmm. and also the more ultimate community, mm-hmm. and more paradigmatic community. So therefore, you have this thicker sense of what the spirituality of the church is. It's not reduced. It's actually, it's more ultimate in this beautiful, thick way. Anyway, so.
Yeah. And I think that's part of the answer to your question about how to avoid a kind of dictatorial ecclesiocracy where you have the church ordering civil authorities around. I think part of the answer to that is to recognize the Catholicity of the church. I think it's easier to fall into that kind of ecclesiocracy if you're thinking in terms of a church within a particular national realm that the church has that kind of authority. If you're thinking of it as having, again, it's an international body, and it's a body of a different order. It's not, you're not competing. The church is not competing in the same political space. It is a political institution, but it's a political body that has a heavenly origin rather than an earthly origin. And I think that's a very general way of addressing the question, but I think the church remembering its nature as the body of Christ, as the temple of the Spirit, what you're talking about is a proper spirituality of the church.
Yep.
Recognizing that, I think, is foundational to avoiding that kind of dictatorial tendency.
That's really good. Yeah. I do think helping Christians, I think one of the things, like the practical impetus of our project is just trying to help Christians foreground their ecclesial identity. And it's going to get complicated. What does that mean for things like war? Okay, of course. But even just more fundamental, I mean, like, who are you? And, you know, is the Apostles' Creed more significant than your national creed? I mean, they don't have to be competitive necessarily, but there has to be an ordering of loves there. I mean, a proper Augustinian sense. And that is going to shape the way you think about those matters. So I think getting Christians just themselves to cherish and love what the beauty of the church is. But then also, I think, as we think about our respective nations, even if we don't want an ecclesiocracy, I think one of the ways we resist the Lockeanism and this reduction of the church, there's other things we could have talked about, like the reduction of religion to a choice or an option. You could kind of go the Charles Taylor route, you know, there, like, and already making it optional is a denial of its reality, which is like D.C. Schindler's main argument, right? Like, it is, I think one of the things I would want and pray for, and I don't know exactly how this spells out, but is to get the civil powers to honor the integrity of the truth of the body, right? Now, what does that mean in a divided church? A major question. But just even recognizing the fact that there is a more ultimate community to which human persons are ordered, I do think is something at the civil level that I would really advocate for. And what you call that, I don't know, and how that cashes out, but that is something I think a thickly ecclesiocentric political theology is going to push towards.
Anyway. Yeah, my argument in my Constantine book is that is a central part of what the Constantinian system as a historical political order was.
Yeah,
it's the it wasn't Constantine taking over the church and becoming it. The church becoming simply an arm of Roman order. There's aspects of that, that's for sure, but I don't think that's the fundamental reality. I think the fundamental reality is Constantine encountered the living God, kissed the Son Jesus, and also paid respect to the bride of Christ, and did what he could to support and not to control. At least that was not the main mode of engagement, but to facilitate the work of the church and the unity of the church. And I think that is, to my mind, that's kind of the focal point of Constantinian order of Christendom.
Great.
Well, one of the things you brought up, James, again going back to some of your earlier questions, is that how do we pursue any kind of a agenda within a divided church? And I think I think the ecclesiocentric model helps us to address that to some degree, particularly if we're thinking about it in terms of actual congregations of Christians in actual settings, in actual local areas, you know, next door to or down the road from other churches, from other denominations. I've argued in various places for a kind of local ecumenism, a local Catholicity that can, you know, start from some very basic things like churches praying for one another, you know, instead of praying for your denomination in the pastoral prayer on Sunday, the denomination that contains churches whose pastors you don't know, whose members you've never had any contact with, instead you know get the secretary to call the secretary of the Methodist church up the road, or the Baptist church on the other side of town, or the Korean church that's just been planted, and ask them what they need and how they can be prayed for. I certainly don't want to say that praying for one another is a small thing. It looks like a small thing. It's not. But that would be, I mean, that's something that any church anywhere can do. Mm-hmm. It doesn't require any kind of ecumenical convergence. It's just a matter of Christians recognizing each other's Christians and recognizing that we in fact do bear one another's burdens, even if we don't know one another. And we should get to know one another. I mean, I thought in our setting in Birmingham, Alabama, the one thing that everybody knows about Birmingham, Alabama, is that there are police dogs and fire hoses that are directed against African Americans. That's what everybody in the world knows about Birmingham, even, you know, 50 years after the fact. That's what people remember. It's not the racially divided city it once was, but it's certainly not a racially unified city. And there have to be practical ways that, and I know that a lot of churches in Birmingham pursue this, try to find ways at least to have some kind of brotherhood, genuine brotherhood, across that racial divide. How can predominantly white churches befriend predominantly African American churches and vice versa? In Birmingham, that racial division is as important as any kind of denominational division. Everybody down here is some form of Baptist.
Even the Presbyterians.
Even the Presbyterians, yeah. But, you know, the racial division is real. So there are things like that that can be pursued within it. And again, the those look like small things. They don't look like political action.
Yep.
They don't look like they have anything to do with liberalism or combating liberalism. But in fact, they are, because if you're a part of a church that's pursuing unity with another church of another, you know, a Hispanic church or an African American church or an immigrant church in the same city, then you are forging bonds that reestablish the one church as a distinct body within that city. You're taking steps in that direction, and that is a kind of post-liberal move.
Yeah, and we need to do it to be the church. We need to see those things as publicly significant.
Yeah.
And we also need to do things like that if we're going to have any credibility to also then not only embody those things that you're talking about, but also then speaking to. I mean, like, one of the things that I love about, as we think about the public role of the church, and besides just embodying it in its own life, but also then teaching magistrates or things like that, and being a revelation of truth. Well, how do you do that if you're not fighting for, if the core truth that we're seeking to promote is the gospel of reconciliation, and yet we're divided, you know, intractably at odds with one another without any sort of grievance or grieving about it. Mm-hmm. I don't know how we have any credibility to teach in any way. And so I think it's all these things are actually seeking to live these out in internal to the life of the church is extremely relevant to our kind of external messaging as well. All right. That's all I have for today. I think this covered some good territory.
Yeah. Thank you. That was fun.
Thank you once again for joining us for another installment of the Civitas podcast of the Theopolis Institute. We look forward to our future conversations and hope you will join us again.